Our news from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sit for Less, selling all colors of the Herman Miller Aeron chair online, including Sit for Less True Black, online at sitforless.com.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, roasting coffee daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Also offering a variety of tea and chai. Open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information is available at 352-9713.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2. We're streaming online at will.illinois.edu. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Thanks for tuning in today. Most of us are untouched by the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. This afternoon, in this portion of the program, we are going to talk about those who serve. Our guest is journalist Bill Murphy, Jr. He's written a profile of the West Point class of 2002. They had entered the academy in a time of peace, but not long after the beginning of their senior year, on September 11, 2001, terrorists struck the United States. At their commencement, President Bush said America would, in his words, take the battle to the enemy. Murphy is the author of In a Time of War, The Proud and Perilous Journey of West Point's Class of 2002. Of this class, Murphy notes, in the era of the all-volunteer army, the common measure of civic responsibility had shifted. A great gulf had opened between those who served in the military and those who didn't. Americans no longer believed they had to serve to be good citizens. Instead, they simply had to support the troops, whatever that might mean. Listeners, join us with your questions and comments. Your phone calls are invited. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Bill Murphy, Jr. worked as Bob Woodward's research assistant on the book State of Denial. A lawyer and former Army Reserve officer, Murphy reported from Iraq for the Washington Post in 2007. He was a lawyer at the U.S. Department of Justice from 1998 to 2001. He served as a U.S. Army JAG officer for more than 2 years, beginning early in 2003. In a Time of War, The Proud and Perilous Journey of West Point's Class of 2002 is published by Henry Holt. Again, our phone numbers, if you'd like to join us this afternoon, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Bill Murphy, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hi, Celeste. It's nice to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Sure. How are you?
I'm great, thanks.
Good, good. Thinking back to this idea that you express early, very early in your book, In a Time of War, to be good citizens no longer requires service, but simply to support the troops, whatever that might mean. One of the members of the class of 2002 who figures prominently in the book is Todd Bryant. When he applied to West Point, what was his view of service to country?
I think, Todd, he's from Southern California, and if you ever met him, he has this sort of surfer dude vibe to him. But underneath that, you realize that this is somebody who thought service, and specifically military service, was just extremely important. And I think it had a lot to do with family tradition. Both his parents were military officers in the Air Force, and he has an older brother is a Marine Corps officer, and a sister who is actually ahead of him at West Point. So I think that's something you find, not with everyone at West Point, but, you know, like all colleges, like all professions, we find there are family legacies in them. And, you know, certainly West Point's no different, and absolutely in the Bryant family that was the case.
Yeah. And Todd Bryant, he thought after his service was over, after his commitment to serve following West Point was completed, he'd like to continue to serve in public service.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And, you know, it's funny. Exactly what we're talking about here has been a debate, I think, at West Point and in the military for a while. You talk to cadets and you talk to soldiers, and they'll talk about the notion of service. And if you dig a little bit deeper, you can get into a pretty fascinating debate over whether they mean service to their community and their world or whether they mean service in the military. So if you take someone like Todd, yeah, he'd talk about wanting to run for office someday. He'd talk about wanting to either go back home or wherever he wound up living and be a teacher, and he thought that would be a great way to serve the community. But it's something you hear about all the time. You can have these very long, interesting debates. I was at West Point just a couple of weeks ago, and it's interesting to talk to the current cadets who are almost a decade younger, and it's the same debate that they're having that the class of 02 had.
Mm. Do they talk about what it means, what it should mean to be a good citizen in terms of those of us who are not in the military?
Yeah, you know, that's such an interesting question. And, you know, I had an opportunity at one point when I was thinking about that question myself, and I thought, why don't I just ask all these soldiers? I've after writing this book and reporting and the like, I had email addresses for something like 700 or 800 Army officers. Mm-hmm. So I just sent it out to them and said, you know, what do you guys think about these issues? What do you think about civilian service? And one of the ways I phrased it was, you know, you see all these, you see the bumper stickers on the back of people's cars saying support the troops. Well, what do you really think we should be doing?
Mm.
And you get a lot of different reactions, as you can imagine. But the overall reaction I heard was just asking people to pay attention. The military, by and large, is still a fairly conservative organization politically.
Mm-hmm.
But I've heard a lot of respect for, you know, even people whose opinions they didn't agree with. If they thought they were paying attention, it wasn't just respect for the opinions. It was, you know, we're counting on you to be the ones debating where we should be and where we should be sent. Because once they actually take the oath, they have more or less sworn to follow the orders that we as a country give them. So they want us on the outside to be debating those issues pretty aggressively.
Mm. And voting?
I beg your pardon?
And voting?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Although, you know, I got a laugh. I was talking to a few at the same time, and, you know, one said, yes, voting. Oh, yes, voting. And the third one said, no, how about informed voting?
Point well taken.
Yeah, yeah.
In a letter you wrote that came with a book from Henry Holt, you tell the story of how this book, In a Time of War, came to be. Would you share this story with our listeners?
Sure. You know, there are probably two answers. I think I know the one you're talking about, but I think I had in the back of my mind from the start of, you know, from 9/11 or from the start of the Iraq War, that eventually I wanted to write something about this, about what it meant to be a soldier. And I think that came out of my own personal experience of having been called up in the reserves, and although I didn't go to Iraq as a soldier, having a brother who was over there. But specifically how this came about was that I actually worked for Bob Woodward of the Washington Post, and in the process of actually getting that job with Bob to work on his books, he had me actually critiquing one of his older books. And in that book, there was a scene where President Bush goes to West Point on June 1st of 2002, in which he outlined what came to be known as the Bush Doctrine or the Preemption Doctrine. It's sort of the philosophical underpinnings for why we said we were justified to invade Iraq when we hadn't actually been attacked by them first. And it really struck me that, you know, Bush's speechwriters thought that this speech was as important as, say, Winston Churchill's Iron Curtain speech. And, you know, they didn't always travel with the president, but they were there because they wanted to see history. And the thing that struck me overall was that, you know, Churchill gave that speech at a civilian college, not in his own country, when he was no longer a head of state. But Bush went and actually gave the speech to the brand new officers in the United States Army who would actually be carrying out the policy that he was speaking, that he was outlining in his speech. And I remember I wrote to Bob in this memo that I wrote about the whole thing and said, you know, what we ought to think about doing is let's see if we can't track down some of those brand new lieutenants and you know, this was originally for a Woodward book, so he writes a sort of Washington-centric book. And I said, well, let's see if we can have a parallel story about these young lieutenants. And it didn't quite fit into Bob's book, but I had begun working on it. And, you know, I think sometimes you can get involved in a story, and it's not just that it takes on a life of its own, it's that you feel compelled to see it through. It wasn't that it all became easy, it's that I thought this is something that has to be told.
Hmm. And then members of the class of 2002 began contacting you. What did they want to talk about?
Yeah, it's interesting, and it was actually very, flattering is not the right word, I suppose gratifying, because, you know, I had the freedom to work on a very long-term project, which gives you the freedom to really talk to people, really listen. And so I was fortunate. At the end of every conversation, of course, as a journalist on something like this, when you're really casting a wide net, the last question should be, so who are three more people you think I should talk to? But I was gratified that my reputation preceded me, and that was absolutely true, that I would get phone calls and emails from people that I hadn't sought them out, but they'd say, hey, I heard you talk to my friend from West Point, and if you want my 2 cents, I'm willing to give it to you. And I think, this is several years ago, and I don't know if it's just my experience, but I think the whole country has spent a number of years now talking about what it's like to go to war in the modern era, what it's like to come home, sort of separation between those who've gone and those who haven't. But this is earlier on, and I think they really wanted to just, you know, the idea that someone would just listen, and, you know, that I was clearly interested. It wasn't necessarily that I was a great reporter or a fantastic interviewer. It's that I was, you know, very eager to say, I've got 2 hours. I'd love to hear what it was like to be in Samarra in 2004, that kind of thing.
You were interested.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, absolutely, I was.
Yeah. In the fall of their senior year were the attacks of 9/11. I'm not quite sure what the best question is to ask here. How did it affect the class? Did it lead them to realize the time of peace was coming to an end? What kinds of things were they thinking about in the immediate aftermath of September 11th?
Sure. Well, it's interesting because, you know, there was 18, 19 months between 9/11 and the start of the Iraq War, and I think that really changed the tone, of course. I mean, that's kind of an understatement. But what's interesting, if you go back to 9/11, I didn't say this quite this way in the book, but as I've thought about it more, I think some of these cadets felt like they had scratched a winning lottery ticket. And the idea is that, you know, not that they were bloodthirsty and wanted to go to war, although, you know, I mean, let's be honest, in the aftermath of 9/11, I think there were a lot more people who were, you know, we didn't have lines outside the recruiting stations, but there were people who felt we'd been hit hard and we should hit back. And you know, I'll admit I was in the reserves and I was the first one to volunteer, not that I went, but in the end. But the other thing I think to think about, though, is that their impression of what a war was something like the Gulf War, where, you know, we're talking 60, 90, 100 days and the whole thing's over and no Americans are hurt. And, you know, you come home afterwards and you've done your duty and you can be proud of that for the rest of your life. And I think that's why I say, you know, they felt like they'd scratched a lottery ticket. And, you know, as some of them explained it to me earlier on, it's like, you know, if you graduated from medical school and then, you know, go through your residency and the next thing you know, you've got, you know, a huge important life-saving surgery that they turn to you and say, okay, doctor, I know you're the brand new one here, but you're the one who's going to do it. You'd be thrilled, you know. I don't think it was, you know, soul-searching, moralistic, what's the nature of war. I think it was, country's going to go to war, and we happen to be the ones to go do it. You know, this is, in a way, this is pretty cool.
Yeah, and at their commencement, the president said America would take the battle to the enemy. Now, one can sort of imagine, you know, those lottery tickets in the hands of the cadets on the field on that day. On the other hand, there's people watching in the stands, and one of them was a woman by the name of Jen Reardon. It struck her in a very different way.
That's true, actually. And Jen was actually Todd Bryant's fiancée. She's a young college student, Boston College, and, you know, it seems like a great young love story, the two of them, from everything I've heard from reporting this for several years. But the interesting thing is that West Point had seemed, to Jen, and I think to a lot of visitors, it seemed like it wasn't really part of the Army. You know, they talked about the Army and they, I mean, they studied the military and how to be a leader, and they wore uniforms. But from the perspective of a girlfriend, it's sort of, you know, turned fiancé. It's a lot of parades and parties and formal dances and, you know, maybe the annoyance that your boyfriend can't always get away from the campus the way he might if he were at a civilian college. But, you know, in a lot of circles, there's, I think, an element of pride that, you know, this is the choice that your significant other has made and that, you know, you're both giving up something for the country. But there's this moment in the speech when President Bush says simply, "You graduate from this academy in a time of war," and of course that's where the title of the book comes from, "In a Time of War." And I remember Jen saying that all of a sudden it just clicked in her head that, you know, the army with the parades and the parties was the same army that had, you know, soldiers deployed and, you know, fought and sometimes didn't come home. You know, it's one of those things that's obvious, and then suddenly you internalize it, and it means a world of difference.
Yeah, the illusion is shattered,
yeah,
as you say.
Yeah.
The president, just 2 months after September 11, 2001, had ordered Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to update invasion plans for Iraq. When would it have become apparent to the young graduates of West Point in 2002 that the U.S. would invade Iraq?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, on one level, I would say not much sooner, if at all, than it did to the rest of the country. And, you know, none of this happened in a vacuum. You think as we went through 2002, it seems like a long time ago now, but, you know, the public underpinnings for this, let's say, were sort of laid out there. But from the cadets' perspective, and more to the point, when they were second lieutenants, it's not as though division-level invasion plans were being passed down to the most junior officers in the Army. But I think they did start to get concrete notions when they would, you know, report into their units or get in touch with their units that they were going to go to prior to actually reporting, and hear, "Oh yeah, you know, we're alerted for a deployment cycle. It could be Afghanistan. It could be just going to Kuwait in defense, or it could be war. Be prepared." All that sort of thing. So, you know, not so much a direct notion until not that long before the war, quite mm-hmm. honestly. You know, I guess the CIA talks about chatter, right? Well, there's a lot of chatter in the Army if you listen there and keep your ears open. And, you know, at that time we had different camouflage uniforms for desert environment. If you realize, hey, we're all getting desert uniforms, you can kind of put two and two together.
Yeah. West Point cadets receive their education in exchange for 5 years of service and then another three in the reserves. How did the class of 2002 in their freshman year envision their service after graduation, and what did the world look like to them back in 1998?
Yeah, it's a blink of an eye historically, but yeah. It was a very different world for the U.S. Army then. It was, and they'll joke about this now that they would, you know, look forward to and gripe about at the same time the idea of having to go to Bosnia for 6 or 9 months on a peacekeeping tour once in their career as being sort of a hardship or the highlight, depending on, I suppose, what side of the bed they got up on. You think about it, we hadn't, you know, as I say, the last real war that the U.S. had been involved in, certainly with any ground troops, was the Gulf War. And, you know, that was 100 hours of ground combat. It was, you know, the U.S. completely mismatching the Iraqi army, which surrendered en masse. And you have to go back to Vietnam prior to, you know, not only prior to the cadet's birth, but there are very, very few officers at West Point who would have been Vietnam veterans, you know, maybe retired older officers. But even the cadre, as they call it, the officers that are their chain of command on military issues and some of their younger professors who are still in the military, they would have the same notion, the sort of Gulf War notion of what the Army was like. I suppose long, long periods of generally inactive times, punctuated by, you know, 100-day, 100-hour massive United States military victories.
Hmm. And the class of 2002, I'm not so good at math, and I'm sure not good at it real fast. The class of 2002, at the time of the 91 Gulf War, how old would they have been?
Oh, 10, 11,
yeah,
12
kids.
Years old.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's real kids. I mean, little kids.
Yeah, absolutely.
As I think of an 18 or a 22-year-old now as a kid.
So. Yeah, you know, 18 to 22-year-olds don't think of themselves as
no.
kids. But when you get 10 or more years on them and you look back, you say, wow, what did I know then? But I suppose probably that's inevitable as you continue in life. You know, one interesting thing I thought about, just I sat there with a long sort of just looking at how old were they when this happened, and or more to the point, when this happened, how old were they? And if a lot of people would say, if you want to look at the two real, you know, sparks next to the powder keg about where we focus ourselves in terms of foreign policy now, you'd look to maybe the Iranian hostage crisis, and you'd look to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And these, the class of 02, literally were newborns at that time. So they were literally born into this world where these events were happening that would play such a part in their lives that, you know, that obviously it's newborns, but that, let's say their families would never probably have predicted.
Yeah, and Vietnam, way back in the history.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Even, you know, I mentioned Todd Bryant's parents having been in the Air Force, but they were just in the post-Vietnam era. So even, you know, you'd have to go back even ahead of the parents of some of these students to find people that actually, you know, were the boomers, that type of thing, or actually would have been in Vietnam.
So what was the focus of military training at West Point for the class of 2002, and has it changed? And if it's changed since then, how has it changed?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because as I said, I'd been in the Army, but I didn't go to West Point. Although I developed a lot of respect for West Point, it would not have been the right choice for me. But one thing I did come away with respect for is that, especially since the start of the Iraq War, I think the focus and the curriculum there has changed a lot, at least insofar as it involves the military arts. And, you know, the entire Army, actually, and I suppose I put the Marine Corps in there as well, has in the last 5 or so years really taken a look at how it fights wars, how it fights counterinsurgency. You hear people talk about COIN left and right. And if you look at who actually were the authors of the new American strategy, the updated American strategy for how to fight a counterinsurgency, they all came out of West Point. And by that, I mean not just that, you know, many of them were West Point graduates. I mean that many of them were actually West Point professors. And so you can see how that, you know, would affect what's actually taught in the classroom. And I think another sometimes overlooked example is the fact that these cadets were probably just graduating right at the time when they were first able to talk to their older peers, you know, just a year or two ahead of them, who are actually out, as we would say, in the field, in Afghanistan and the like, or just back. So you could have, you know, email conversations back and forth, listservs. This is, you know, kind of before Facebook and the like, which is, I mean, now it's a completely different revolutionary environment there. But where they were, you know, their education was coming not just from the formal education from West Point, but informally, hearing back from the lieutenants just a year or two older than they were, who are actually already at war or just back.
Hmm.
Yeah.
What are the friendships like that are forged at West Point?
I would say it is, by and large, a place where people make very, very close friends. You know, I think across the spectrum, people who've served in the military often look back at the experiences and the friendships they made in the military as lasting. And in part, because it's probably because of the intensity of the experiences. And that has to do not just with combat, of course, because it still is a minority of troops who ever actually see combat. But it's the training, it's the sort of shared hardships, the sometimes the intentional misery that, you know, builds camaraderie. And I would say that, you know, absolutely impacts them. But the other thing I think is that they are a bit more diverse group than I think I understood when I first started writing about them.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, they have this shared, not just experience, but motivation. You know, just the, you know, the fact that you can see guys and women who've gotten out, and, you know, I was going to say guys because I think of, you know, they grow their hair long and they, you know, are as trendy as any other civilian, but they'll still in 2 minutes, you know, switch to a conversation about service and about, you know, what we're put on this earth for. That it's a little bit different than maybe people who, you know, have come up through the civilian system.
Our guest this afternoon is journalist Bill Murphy, Jr., author of In a Time of War, The Proud and Perilous Journey of West Point's Class of 2002. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455, 333-WILL 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call now from a listener on line one in Champaign County. Good afternoon.
Hi. I called earlier this morning. I do call a lot. And I had a similar reference, which was there's a cover story on the latest Harper's Magazine about proselytizing and the kind of the right-wing Christian influence inside the military. Was covered by Democracy Now! This morning, which is aired later, and had this Air Force guy who is Jewish who is filing a suit against at the Air Force Academy. I don't know if there's anything comparable at West Point. I've always thought perhaps it's entirely more secular, but it's a pretty shocking story. It relates to this coverage by Al Jazeera of some amateur footage from a GI in Afghanistan documenting the kind of urge to proselytize that some preachers were military chaplains actually were using there. So it's a whole amazing story in itself, and it's sort of breaking now. I don't know how much it'll actually be on the press, but I would curious how you would react to that, and then since you specifically wrote about West Point, I would be glad to hear that that East Coast Bastion is more secular than the Air Force Academy at Colorado Springs.
Sure. Well, thanks for calling. Yeah, I'm certainly familiar just from news reports with the his name is on the tip of my tongue, Mickey. And in any event, I believe he's a Air Force Academy graduate who's actually done a lot to get the story out there about the Air Force Academy. You do certainly run into evangelical Christian cadets and officers. I never had the sense that it was quite the issue at West Point that it's been apparently at the Air Force Academy. There were a couple of stories I ran into about things like that, but they didn't seem to be, the plural of anecdote is not data, and it didn't strike me that this was a major, major issue there the way it's been portrayed to be at the Air Force Academy. That said, you find a lot of cadets and a lot of officers who will talk about how faith is important to them. I don't think it's it's a secular institution in that it's run by the United States government, but I don't think I would say for a minute that a majority of people there would describe themselves as secular. But I haven't, at least I've spent a lot of time there, and I haven't heard complaints from people that, at least not that many, that they felt pressured to conform. I'm thinking of quite a few atheist cadets and officers I know, and a lot of sort of, twice a year Easter and Christmas Christians, and some that were, found their faith important to them, and others that, at this stage in their life, at least, it wasn't as much of a priority.
Yeah. I've just pulled up his name. It's Mikey Weinstein, and he was a former lawyer for the Reagan administration, so he's kind of an Air Force Republican stock, but he has some children that graduated from the Air Force Academy, and they all felt that they were the odd people out because of their faith. And the story that came out of Afghanistan that actually resulted in some Bibles being burnt by the military because they were written in Pashto and they were designed to be distributed in Afghanistan. So it's an interesting story. What we do have at the heyday of the attack on Iraq, the Jerry Boykins, head of Special Forces, going around in his fatigues talking about how his God was bigger than. But anyway, I wanted to raise that. Thank you.
Okay, let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line two. Hi. Line two? Line two? Champaign? We have a caller there or not? I think we'll see what's up there, and we'll go back to the conversation with Bill Murphy, Jr., author of In a Time of War.
I'm just thinking of one more point on what that last caller brought up. I think most people I talk to in the military would say that they hope to be held to a higher standard. I mean, you know, whether they actually are is a different story. But having been a JAG officer, I think sometimes it can be easy to get. How to put this? I'll put it differently. I mean, you see a lot of things as a prosecutor in the military, and you think, my God, how did this person ever wind up in the military? How did this person ever wind up in a position where he or she could possibly be out there representing the United States? And then you realize we're talking about such a huge organization that, you know, we're going to have examples of that in any organization. So, the caller brought up General Boykin, which is probably not going to go down in the annals of intelligent cross-cultural speeches. Mm-hmm. I always wonder. I mean, these are the things that are going to get pushed to the forefront, and I wonder where we get to that point where we're talking about trends as opposed to, incidents or individuals. Having been in the military myself, I never actually experienced that, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Mm.
Bill Murphy, Jr., our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. If you'd like to join us, listeners, with a question or a comment, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Another cadet soldier central to In a Time of War is Drew Sloan. And you say the first he heard of West Point was in a Tom Clancy novel. And this goes to diversity, I think, and some of the issues involved in our first caller's comments. Tell us about Drew Sloan's background and how he got to West Point.
Sure. Yeah, Drew actually grew up in Fayetteville, Arkansas. And, his parents, I would say, were at least his mother, I'd say, would be anti-military, or even, at least anti-war, but maybe even anti-military, at least until her son was in the Army. There's a type of character that I've met there over time that it's almost joining the military is the rebellious thing to do against your family, if your family's of a certain, background or persuasion. But Drew's interesting. He actually did very, very well at West Point, near the top of his class, and he led kind of a charmed life. When he was assigned to a unit, he went to the infantry, and he was assigned to Hawaii. And when he did actually go to war, it was in Afghanistan, which at the time was actually in a lot of ways a more rewarding assignment. But the first casualty his unit took was Drew Sloan himself. And he actually was very badly injured and wound up in Walter Reed for quite some time. But the thing I found most compelling about Drew is that he went through his whole recovery period, involved massive facial injuries and surgery after surgery. But he wound up turning down a medical discharge and staying in the Army and doing another tour in Iraq. Iraq the second time, Afghanistan the first time. And we had some really interesting and long conversations about what that thought process was and why he did that when, I'd always have asked the question, how much do you have to do before you feel like your obligation has been filled? You joined the Army, you went to Afghanistan, you took a shot to the face, and here you are.
Yeah. Let's take another couple of calls. Next we go to a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello. There's been a lot of talk about interrogation techniques and torture and things. Have the cadets had, is training changed on that? And what are the cadets' views about these issues? And I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay, thanks.
Sure. That's a really, really interesting question. You know, the ironic thing is, as young lieutenants, as young captains, it's not really what they were doing in terms of interrogation. But in the longer term, one thing I found very interesting was during the campaign, the presidential campaign, there was a group called Veterans for Obama that, of course, was part of the Obama effort. And they did a commercial, and I looked at the commercial, and I realized that I knew almost every single person involved in that group, at least as a spokesperson. And the reason is that they were mostly young officers. They were from the Naval Academy. They were from West Point. And some of them have been very outspoken on, their reaction to exactly the news that you're talking about. That's, you know, that it sort of trickled out over time, but even now as it's come out in greater detail. You'll hear, you know, as you might expect, I hear sort of two sides of this. I hear the sort of, you know, yes, it's rough stuff, but it's necessary and it's used sparingly, at least in terms of the number of people. And then I hear the other side saying, you know, that we have much larger issues that we need to be concerned about. Not meaning we shouldn't be concerned about what our military is doing, but that we have other considerations. We don't just consider whether this particular technique will get information. We consider, you know, how many more insurgents are we creating by doing this, or how many resources are we sending to chase down false leads as a result of this. So, you know, it is sometimes a little bit hard for me to pigeonhole, you know, how they feel about not just this issue, but many issues. And I think, honestly, that goes to the somewhat unexpected diversity I found among them in a whole manner of issues.
Yeah. Let's take another call. A listener in Charleston, line 4. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I served in Iraq in 03 and 04 as a 19-year-old grunt in the infantry. And I met many of the thoughtful, introspective young officers that had strong feelings on service to their country and to the world as a whole. But I also met many officers who were very career-oriented and who didn't seem to have, you know, that thoughtfulness, and who seemed that they wouldn't have a problem, you know, maybe mistreating detainees as long as they could get the job done or look good to the higher-ups. And I wonder if you could comment on those officers who you know, behave that way or who have a different view of the world and of the military.
Sure. Well, before I forget to, let me say thanks for joining and for going over there. It's not a choice that everybody makes, and I appreciate you having doing that personally, so thank you for that. You know, remember a minute ago I was saying that, you know, the diversity among these people, I mean, you know, there's good, there's bad, and there's ugly. And, you know, when I've had the opportunity to go back and talk to cadets more recently, I often, you know, one of the messages that I try to leave is, you know, don't just have a career you can be proud of. And often that means, I tend to think, keeping an eye out for what else you could be doing, so that if that moment does come when you need to decide, you know, is my moral compass going to allow me to consider doing what I'm being asked to do, that your decision won't be made based on the fact that you've got, you know, 14 years in and you need 20 to get your pension, or the fact that your kids need health insurance, that type of thing. It'll be based on that inner core of what you feel your moral compass is telling you is the right thing to do. And one thing I find really interesting is that I think, you know, the caller talked about being in Iraq in 03 and 04. I think that was probably the beginning of when you would see a lot of officers stepping up and putting their careers on the line. There's a guy I'm thinking of, a lieutenant colonel by the name of Paul Yingling. And this is actually 07. He wrote in a professional journal an article called A Failure in Generalship. And this seems like kind of a dry academic thing until you step back and realize that he's a colonel saying that all his bosses had failed, and publishing it in a journal that would be read by all of the senior leadership in the Army, right about the time when he's, you know, trying to get to the next level of his career in the Army. By all indications, the article changed people's attitudes, shook things up, and also ended his career. And I think it's, you know, we'll hear, you know, there was actually a member of the class of 02 who wound up court-martialed for mistreating detainees. But, you know, again, I sometimes have a hard time pulling out the one person. My overall lesson was just how different they are and how, you know, like I say, you'll get some that you'll be wondering, how on earth did this person get commissioned? And others, you'd say, wow, I'd follow this person anywhere.
Does the listener want to follow up?
Well, yes. So you've had the opportunity to speak to newer cadets and newer officers since the wars have began. So what is your overall opinion of the ones that have joined or decided to serve since these wars have started? How do they approach
Yeah, that's a great question. It's something I've actually spent a lot of time thinking about. I mean, you know, it's one thing to join prior to the war, and it's another thing to join when, and especially where you're going to have a four-year preparation before you actually go out in the Army at a place like West Point. I find a few things. I find that they talk about these things a lot. Celeste asked before how the curriculum had changed at West Point, and these issues come up all the time. And I think that's, you know, in a lot of professional programs, a lot of it, I think, is putting yourself in the position of the person who's going to have to make these decisions over and over and sort of rehearsing them before you're actually involved in them. So I think, you know, we do see a lot of that. The one thing that does concern me a little bit, though, is that I think we see I don't want to say a shrinking of the number, but maybe a shrinking of the demographic pool of who actually is going to go and join the military now. Because we've had, you know, God, we're into the eighth year in Afghanistan and the sixth year in Iraq. Is that right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And where we see people who are willing to volunteer for that again and again, I think the pool is not diversifying. The numbers might be larger because West Point still gets just as many applications, and they've actually increased the number of people in the class. But when they step back and they talk to their peers, the definition of who their peers is changes. I don't know if that's too esoteric, but that's the thing I've been thinking about a lot lately.
Mm. The other thing, there's a soldier in the story who is talking to his wife, and he says, plan on a year, pray for 6 months. I don't know if I could do a year, but he's committed and he's there. He's going to do it. And this gets to the idea of the career-oriented officer or officers. How have the long, numerous deployments affected the officer corps of the military, of the various branches?
Yeah, that's been a very important thing to address lately for the military because I stay in touch with so many of the people from the West Point class, and I found that the question of whether they agreed with the war was not the overriding concern in terms of whether they stayed in the military past 5 years or not. The question was, can I have a family? Can I, you know, A, meet a significant other and B, actually raise a family with that person if I'm going to be doing, you know, a year at home, a year in Iraq, a year at home, a year and a half at home, a year in Afghanistan, as far as the eye can see? And so I think that, you know, it's been fairly well reported that the Army faced a pretty significant problem with too many, you know, too few captains deciding to stay in for the slots that they had to fill. And then, you know, one of their solutions one of their more recent solutions, I should say, has been to get the younger cadets right when they're coming out of West Point and get them to agree to longer commitments. So I was actually up there a couple of weeks ago, and I'm talking to a young cadet who's going to be commissioned later this month. And he's agreed to stay on active duty until the year 2020. You say, well, I'm on the one hand, power to him, but on the other hand, you know, like we were talking about, when you're 22, do you know, there aren't many things in this country, in this culture, that we ask people to make an 11-year commitment to, and that's what we're asking some cadets to do now.
There's a soldier in the story by the name of Eric Huss, and after a couple of battles, he realizes that the fear of death didn't bother him too much, but he was deeply disturbed by the feeling of killing. This goes to say that you really don't know until you're there and in it.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's absolutely true. I think on the one hand, you know, God, this goes back to the stories that I've heard from people as early as World War II, and I'm sure it was in previous wars, although, of course, I didn't meet those people, but who said that once they accepted that they were probably going to die, the likelihood of dying actually dropped because they were no longer scared of it or as scared, and they were a little bit more able to focus on what they had to do to survive, which is somewhat of a paradox. But the other side of it, this notion, I don't know if they do more now, but at the time, I don't think people actually spent a lot of time thinking about what it would be like to kill, what that would mean. And it really hit Eric. Now, he, you know, certainly stayed on and continued to do what he'd sworn he would do in terms of leading his soldiers. But I think that played a significant part in his decision later to get out of the army. You know, I actually went to Iraq as a reporter, and there was a moment where there was a firefight going on around me, and where I had to actually think, if we actually did get overrun here, would I be the one to pick up a weapon? And it was a crystal clear moment, the way I'd never actually thought about it before. On the one hand, you're not supposed to do that as a reporter.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, here we are. This is sometimes the rules made back in Washington don't seem to apply when you're there in the circumstance. But I remember sitting there thinking, even playing all that out, would I be able to pick up a rifle and actually shoot someone, even though I knew they were going to kill me? And, you know, fortunately, I wasn't ever faced with that choice. But that was in that moment, I will probably remember for the rest of my life, just clicking my mind, could I actually do this?
Yeah. Let's take one more call, and we'll have to be quick. A listener on a cell phone waiting for us on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, good afternoon. I know we're out of time. I just wanted to thank the caller. I only caught parts of it, and for his service, and I still thank all of the men and young men and women who served. They're the finest we have, and I really appreciate them. I've known them and worked with them, but I am an old Vietnam combat vet, 1969, 70, and 71, and I can tell you, you have never seen failed alter leadership when you can compare it to Westmoreland. And Rumsfeld was a joke, absolute joke. Worst leadership we've ever had. Even McNamara was better than that. But I got to tell you, West Point is excellent. I really respected the officers. I was a sergeant, but I think it's still true today, and I'd like to hear your comment. Without the sergeants, the first sergeants, the guys who run the show, as we used to say, and I would wish the draft was back. That's my two comments. Who really runs the Army, and what about the draft coming back with the draft?
Okay, let's turn it over.
I know we're short on time here. Well, let me start by saying thanks for going to Vietnam, for volunteering like you did, and you are absolutely right. It is the NCOs, the non-commissioned officers, who run the Army. You know, most of these lieutenants, when they get to their first unit, they are the first to admit that they rarely know anything. And who are they relying on? It's the sergeant first class, the platoon sergeant, in the Marine Corps, the gunnery sergeant, who's the company first sergeant. Absolutely. And in terms of a draft, you know, most of them would say no, and it is because of the experience of Vietnam, because of their concern for, you know, in a firefight, that they want the soldier who's next to them to be the one who's actually volunteered and wants to be there. But I'm certainly with you in terms of seeing the cost that we don't really spread out the notion of military service the way we at least think that we did in earlier generations.
Mm. There we have to leave it. Bill Murphy, Jr., thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
Bill Murphy, Jr. is the author of In a Time of War, The Proud and Perilous Journey of West Point's Class of 2002. The publisher is Henry Holt. It's 1:54. Let's go now to Todd Gleason for settlement prices from Kansas City and Chicago.
Thanks much, Celeste. Take a look at those numbers as they settled up in Chicago. On this Wednesday afternoon, futures in the wheat pit finished like this. Nearby July contract at 558¾. Settlement price, it was up 5¼. July, of course, the harvest month. The lead option is the May, 547¾. There, up 6¼. The high price at 548¾. The low at 537. Settled at 547¾, up 6¼. Again, the July up 5¼, 61¾. The high, the low at $5.48. Settlement price for July wheat at 558¾, up 5¼. September futures, a 588¼ top, bottom at 76¼. Settlement price at $5.85½, up 5¼. In Kansas City, July hard red settled at $6.07 a bushel. It finished 8¼ higher. From the corn pit back in Chicago, from the CME Group, May futures, 402¼ was the high, the low at the $3.96, and a settlement price at $4.75. Up 2¼. July futures 409½. The high, the low at 2½, and a settlement price at 407½. Up 2¼. September futures 417¾. The high, the low at 411¾. Settlement price at $4.16, up 1 3/4 in December corn. The harvest month, $4.28 3/4. For the top, the bottom at $4.22 1/4. Settlement price at $4.26 3/4. December corn futures, $4.26 3/4. A settlement, a penny and 3/4 higher. March futures, $4.40 1/2. The high, the low at $34 3/4. Settlement price at $4.39 1/4 a bushel, up 1 3/4. May oat futures up 3 3/4 at $2.03. July at $2.08, up 3 3/4 as well. Soy complex now, nearby May bean futures, $11.35 the high, the low at $11.11. Settlement price $11.35, up 19 cents. July $11.19 the high, the low at $10.97. And the settlement price at $11.18, up 17. August contract $10.78 1/4 the high, the low at $10.59 1/4. Settlement price at $10.77, up 15 1/2. In September futures, $10.23 1/4 the high, the low at $10.09 3/4. Settlement price at $10.23, up 16 cents. November soybean futures, the harvest month, $9.79 1/4 the high, the low at $57 1/4. Settlement price at $9.78. November beans up 17 1/2. The January futures there at $9.81 3/4, settled 17 1/4 higher. May bean meal futures today, $361.50 the high, the low at $356.40. Settlement price at $359, up 50 cents. And the May oil, $838.97. Top bottom at $38.13, settled at $38.65, up 96. I'll return in 9 minutes with the closing mark report when we'll talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Let's take a look now at livestock contracts. They finished higher on the day, except for the June live cattle contract. The high there, $82.85. The low, $81.85. The settlement, $81.87 1/2, down 25. August, $83.05. The high, $82.20. The low, $82.35. The settlement, that up 12 1/2. October, $87.40. The high, $86.67 1/2. The low, the settlement, $86.90. That up 25. December live cattle, $89.55. The high, $88.75. The low, $88.95. The settlement, that up 7 1/2. May feeder cattle, $98.35. The high, $97.60. The low, $97.70. The settlement, that up 27 1/2. August, $99.55. The high, $98.75. The low, $99.00. The settlement, that up 22 1/2. September, $99.75 the high, $98.95 the low, $99.15 the settlement, that up 15. October, $99.75 the high, $99.10 the low, the settlement, $99.42 1/2, that up 17 1/2. May lean hogs, today's high, $58.80 the low, $57.40 the settlement, $58.70 that up 2.90. June lean hogs, $67.20 the high, the low, $66.20 the settlement, $67.10 that up 2.30. July, $70.15 the high, the low, $68.80 the settlement, $70.10 that up 2.32 1/2. August, $70.90 the high, $69.90 the low, $70.80 the settlement, that up 1.90. May bellies, $81.00 even the high, $80.50 the low, $80.50 the settlement, up 105. The Dow is currently up 86 at 84.96. The NASDAQ up 4 points at 17.58. The S&P 500 up 14 at 9.18. Nearby crude in New York trading up 2.50 at 56.27. It's coming up on 2 o'clock. You're tuned to WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3. Urbana. This is the Afternoon Magazine. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Our technical director today, Henry Frayne. My name is Celeste Quinn. Dan Pounder's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon: in northern and central sections, mostly cloudy with a few scattered showers and isolated thunderstorms. South, cloudy with periods of rain and isolated thunderstorms. Highs generally ranging between 70 and 76, except cooler in the mid-60s along the Chicago lakefront. Tonight in northern and western Illinois,